Welcome to Geopolitical Horizons, the podcast from thegeopolity.com. This week, we will be covering the key questions you guys had for us. We asked you on a number of different platforms for your questions on geopolitics, and today we will hopefully go through all of these. So thanks for all those people who sent their questions in, which I've categorized. I will put them to Geopolity founder Adnan Khan. The bulk of the questions were actually on the topic of Palestine, so we'll get through those first. Adnan, how are you keeping first?
Yeah, I'm good, Yusuf. How are you keeping?
Yeah, very well. We're fast approaching 9 months, which is a crazy amount of time since the conflict in Gaza began. Where do things stand currently?
Yeah, so firstly, Yusuf, on this topic, I didn't actually think we would still be talking about the combat or the war itself after 9 months. I would have thought, looking at Israel's capability and looking at the messaging that they were putting out, that they plan to bomb Gaza back to Stone Age, you know, how long would that take? But nevertheless, here we are 9 months down the line, still talking about the genocide, still talking about the last area they're carrying out operations in Rafah, which would indicate that not everything has gone according to plan. Probably the main things really with Gaza at the moment, Yusuf, you've obviously got the Rafah slaughter that's going on at the moment. The slaughter, again, people are watching around the world and are just in shock and horror at what they're witnessing. The pressure on Israel, the credibility of Israel is really rock bottom at the moment. The other thing that's not very clear still, and America keeps saying this to Israel, is what's the day after plan? What do you plan to do after? And the language that Israelis are using, it sounds as though they expect this to still go on. They're talking about the whole of 2024. They're still continuing with some sort of operation. And everyone is seeing the massacre, the deaths, the destruction, the man-made famine that's actually going on. Everyone's actually watching that. So really, probably the main things are, is really there's nothing more for Israel to kill. There's nothing more. There's no more land for Israel to take when it comes to Gaza. They've taken it all. If they haven't taken it directly, they've made sure that people can't reside there because of the slaughter that they carried out. And from an Israeli perspective, there doesn't seem to be any push for working on a post-war plan or even implementing it. But they're going to have to engage some Palestinians, whether they like it or not, whether it's the PLO, whether it's the clans in the Gaza that they keep talking about. So that's from that domestic perspective. The broader perspective, what we've seen is a couple of things develop, really. We've seen the ICJ and the ICC really take a lead on holding Israel accountable to international law. So the ICJ they're about to put out warrants for the arrest of Netanyahu and his defense minister. At the same time, they are planning to put out warrants for the Hamas leadership. And the ICC, at the same time, they have now said that Israel needs to stop what it's doing in Rafah, which in not so many words means it's crossing the red line of international law. And these two have really ticked Israel off. We're finding out literally today that the head of Mossad has been blackmailing or trying to blackmail some of the judges at the ICJ. In America, a number of Republicans signed a letter like the mafia. They effectively threatened the ICC and their families. So we're getting to the point now that the propaganda battle has been completely lost by Israel and its supporters. And its supporters are just resorting to, you know, good old-fashioned violence, good old-fashioned threats. And this is quite an important development, Yusuf, because Israel depends upon propaganda. It depends upon the world viewing Israel through a particular lens that they're the victims, they have a right to exist, and they're trying to exist in a very unstable region. However, that is not the opinion of most people around the world. The opinion of most people around the world, whether it's in Europe, whether it's on the college campuses in America, is there's a genocide going on. And Israel needs to be brought to account. So as far as the Israelis are concerned, they were the victims on the 7th of October. As far as the world is concerned, there's a genocide taking place. It's been televised live, and that needs to be stopped. So those are probably some of the key issues currently and where things are.
The relationship between Biden and Netanyahu, it seems very tense at this moment in time, to the point that we find that Netanyahu, he's openly contradicted Biden's demands. I even have heard some people saying that the reason why Israel wants to extend the war and drag it out, or extend the genocide, should I say even, is that they're waiting for Trump to come back into power. What's your thoughts on this?
So Biden and Netanyahu have always had a contentious relationship. Some of this goes back to the fact that Netanyahu was quite close to Trump, and he had a very good working relationship with Trump. And when Biden was running for the election in 2019, he actually campaigned on the basis that we need to get the region more involved when it comes to the two-state solution. Obviously, Trump, he was pushing a deal of the century. And President Biden, he was very focused on solving the regional issues rather than just Israel. This is what Israel is, and Israel has the right to exist, and it needs support from America. So that really didn't start off the relationship on a good basis. Then Biden refused to engage with MBS in Saudi. He said his father is the leader, so we're going to engage with him. And in fact, he talked about isolating him. So really, the deal of the century, which was critical for Israel because it was a normalization of relationship with Israel by a number of surrounding countries, it came to a complete standstill until Biden then picked it up again. And then really, days or weeks before October the 7th, there's a lot of movement on this front. Then what really probably forced the relationship between the two to rock bottom is the fact that Biden has put demands on Netanyahu. He has criticized Netanyahu on other occasions. So when he supports Israel, he says Israel has the right to defend itself and America will always support Israel. When it comes to criticizing, though, he will single out Netanyahu, that the Netanyahu regime, that the Netanyahu government. So a lot of this, Yusuf, there is a issue, there is tension between the personal relationship. There is also another major issue that Israel's right wing, they don't actually necessarily agree with two states. They don't want to see a Palestinian state. However, they've got a problem. They depend upon the US. They depend upon US arms. They depend upon the US support. So what the right wing are trying to do, they're trying to take advantage of the current circumstances and really, in the context where Israel was under attack, America can't really just dump it. It can't just leave it hanging. And it's election year as well. You know, it wouldn't be good for Biden's prospects if he actually stopped supporting Israel. It would actually hurt his chances. So there's actually a number of factors that have uniquely come together, which has actually made it difficult for America to impose its will on Israel. And what Israel's doing, they're taking advantage of this scenario. They can sense that the hands of the American president are handcuffed and they're really taking advantage of it. So there is a personal element between the two, but there is also a broader issue, which is the Israeli right wing have never been on the same page with America when it comes to a Palestinian state.
Where do you think this is all going to lead to? Do you see an end anytime soon?
So for the moment, Yusuf, the messaging coming out from Israel is they're talking about a long war. They're talking in terms of this ain't going to end anytime soon. So for them, the operation of Gaza isn't the end, really. It's the beginning. So I don't think Israel is looking to, you know, just defeat Hamas, you bomb Gaza back to a stone age, and that's it, they're going to go home. So from that perspective, like they say, if Israel puts his guns down, it would end. But Israel's the aggressor. So if Israel stops being aggressive, the war would come to an end. The only other option here is really externally, conditions are imposed upon Israel. Now, this could come from America. Doesn't seem likely at the moment. In fact, America seems to criticize Israel in the morning, and then by the evening, it's agreed an arms transfer to them. The third option, which is extremely unlikely, but it is possible, is if the Muslim rulers or the Muslim army actually do something about it. At the moment, they haven't. The Muslim rulers are being very loud, but they're not really doing anything. But this recent incident in Rafah, where I think an Israeli tank was attacked by Egyptian forces and it led to the death of two Egyptian soldiers, this has really led to a lot of tension in Egypt. Now it's actually the tension spread to the army, who are very unhappy with actually what's happened. Now, we don't know the full story of what happened here on the border, but what we do know, there's actually a possibility that elements within the army of Egypt had enough. And when they saw the operation in Rafah, they thought they'd do something about it. The Egyptian government is saying they're still investigating, which sounds as though, which is usually what they say when something's gone wrong or someone's gone outside the chain of command. So I think the Gaza massacre, we will see a reduction in the amount of deaths and even the amount of forces sent by Israel at some point. But the broader issue of genocide, the broader issue of occupation, that's not going to end with this. That's going to continue.
You know, with this incident in Egypt, with the military, do we see it at boiling point in the other nations as well? Can we see more of this happening in the likes of Jordan, Lebanon, or do you think it is going to be really contained?
So it's interesting the way Egypt's dealing with it, Yusuf, because two soldiers died. One was not given a lot of coverage. It was just reported in Egyptian TV. However, on social media, the soldier got a lot of coverage. The second soldier, who was from a village, he was buried by his village. He was effectively given a hero's welcome. But the Egyptian authorities have tried to keep that completely quiet. So what that would indicate is they are trying to contain the sentiments of the people. I would say, Yusuf, look, this was going to happen sometime. There's a genocide taking place across the border. Your armed personnel, and you've got to keep in mind, Yusuf, that Egypt now has taken over what they call the Philadelphia Line, which is the agreement in 1979 of the area between Egypt and Israel, where Rafah, where Gaza is. They've actually taken that over. And a lot of Egyptian soldiers who were placed there, they're really, really unhappy with that. So I think that a lot of things has to happen, really, for the conflict to end. But as it keeps on continuing, this is going to lead to a lot of tension in the Muslim world and things reaching boiling point. And this is just what we know, Yusuf. What we're finding is we're finding out things have happened. The regime has kept it quiet. What we're finding out about is months or weeks down the line. And all that indicates that the longer this goes on and the longer the Muslim rulers don't do anything, this is actually leading to a lot of underlying tension building up. And eventually, you know, something's got to give.
One question that we did receive, Adan, was regarding Israel disobeying the US and it's openly attacking the US president, but the US still persists in maintaining cordial relations with Israel. Why is Israel so important to the US that it does carry on with these relations?
So I think the context of this question is if a Muslim ruler did this, he would probably be dead or removed or coup be done against him. It's something that America would never accept. So famously, the Shah of Iran in the 1970s, he attacked America despite all the support they gave him. And as far as America's concerned, well, you know, how dare you? Enough was enough. The relationship America has with Israel is unique from some perspectives. It's unique because there is a major support base domestically in America that supports Israel. So these are not actually Jews. You find the evangelical Christians, and then you find other people who are Zionists because they believe Israel served their agenda. So this faction, in effect, is a support base for Israel in America. So if America or the president decided to abandon Israel, this faction would actually fight for Israel. They would actually defend Israel because they believe it's in America's interest to be in bed with Israel. So I think that the underlying point of this question is it's so unique that America would put up with Netanyahu humiliating them, openly disobeying them, whilst they would never accept that from any other ruler. And that's because there's a unique relationship. As far as America's concerned, Israel is a very good return on investment. It protects America's interests. Relationship can be a bit difficult sometimes, but generally, Israel is a forward base for America in the region. And because there is wide-scale support for Israel in America, it's not just a president can come in and do what he wants with Israel. There is a major support base for Israel that lobbies on their behalf, that actually funds many senators. The Republican that wrote a letter threatening the ICC president, all of them have been funded and aided and received donations from the Zionist lobby. So the relationship with them is very, very unique. And that's why we're seeing this play out now. We're seeing America do things and say things, which is inconceivable with any other country. So this is very unique. However, if Israel can't fulfill the interests of America, if Israel gets in the way of America's interests, America will deal with it. So even Biden, he's trying to deal with Israel, but he's not doing it in an open manner and confrontation. A lot of it is behind the scenes. It's through the Secretary of State, the CIA head, the Defense Secretary visiting Israel on a weekly basis, sitting in cabinet meetings. Through that, they're trying to actually influence Israel. So this is probably a podcast on its own, Yusuf. You just know the American Israeli relationship and the different dynamics.
So you mentioned if Israel starts to affect America's interests. I'm sure we talked about this probably many moons ago about America's plan, America's pivot to Asia. How has the Gaza genocide affected America's pivot to Asia?
So it's not really had any impact on it. I think the reason why the question is asking this is, you know, for at least a decade, America has been talking about China being its focus, Asia being its focus. And what we saw was a lot of actions in the Middle East where America effectively was trying to tie up its presence in the Middle East. It was trying to reduce its presence to focus on the Far East. And with this flare-up, the assumption here is America going to take its eye off the ball when it comes to the Far East? Can America really be engaged in so many issues? Now, I think the important thing to keep in mind here, Yusuf, is America is militarily supporting Israel. It's providing them with arms and equipment and these sort of things. America doesn't have boots on the ground. I know some people have gone from America to go and fight, but this isn't Iraq or Afghanistan where you're seeing major military operation by America. So because of that, this hasn't had an impact on the pivot for Asia. And in fact, I would say, Yusuf, without the Muslim rulers contradicting America, without them intervening, without them supporting the Palestinians, this really isn't going to flare up in the broader region. I know people feel it may. People think it may, but for it to broaden out, things need to happen that effectively go against what the American agenda is. That can only happen if the Muslim rulers or the armies do it. And until that doesn't happen, really, this is largely contained. So the Gaza massacre and genocide is not having an impact on America's policy towards the Far East. But just last week, they put additional sanctions on Chinese technology. So, you know, America can operate in more than one theater. America is the global superpower. It's involved in every region of the world. If there's a flare-up in every region, that's a problem for America. How many issues can you deal with? But for the moment, despite how bad things look and how out of control they look, it's not got to the point where it's overstretching America.
Let's talk about something closer to home, the UK elections. Why has Rishi called for a snap election? It seems like a very bad time for him. I think the outcome is obvious, but I'd like to get your views on it.
Yeah, Rishi Sunak, the UK Prime Minister, Yusuf, I think he's damned either way. The Tories are coming to the end of their 14-year rule. They are deeply unpopular. They have effectively mashed the economy up. For a decade, we had austerity. Austerity led to a cost of living crisis. They are absolutely hated. And that's why the Labour Party is 20 points ahead in the polls. Even if Labour have a bad date on election day, they will still win on the 4th of July, which is when the snap election is. Why did Rishi Sunak call it? Now, I actually personally thought, Yusuf, because there's no chance of winning, he must see out the whole term. The parliamentary term finishes on, I think, the 24th of December this year, which would mean that the election has to happen within 25 days of that. I thought he was going to do that because he's got no support base in the party. They're deeply unpopular. But I think maybe he's taking the opinion, let's just get the pain over with. They know what the outcome is going to be, so let's just get it over with. The problem is you've got many Tory MPs who don't even plan to start. I think 30% of Tory MPs are not even standing, but they know the writing's on the wall. You've got a number of Tories who have set up another party, the Reform Party, who are undermining the Tories. So, you know, it's a complete mess what's going on with the Tories. And the UK probably don't generally vote for divided parties. So it looks like he's throwing, you know, in boxing, you're throwing the towel. When you know the end is near, it seems as though he couldn't take it anymore. And he's throwing the towel.
Is the West losing Ukraine to Russia?
Yes, Yusuf. I think we did our podcast in February. We looked at the 2-year anniversary of the Ukraine war. Russia had a really bad start and the West got really excited thinking we've got them. Ukraine can win. But 2 years on, things have completely changed. Russia's now on top. Ukraine is struggling. Ukraine is completely dependent upon Western arms and the West just don't have no appetite really for this to expand. And that's why there's a lot of talk now in Europe that if Russia takes over Ukraine territory as it has and the Europeans accept it, what's to stop Russia taking over more territory? So there's a lot of talk about continent-wide war. But what you find, Yusuf, is they just don't have the appetite. And really, Ukraine was always going to struggle in the long run when it came to Russia. In America, every debate about Ukraine turns into a long debate. Should they give money? Should they not give money? But where Ukraine needs the help, which is on the battlefield, what you're finding is different countries are dragging their feet. Different countries have promised things but not actually delivered on them. And it seems 2 years down the line, Putin's, what he said in his speech is coming true. He said there's two things the West are forgetting, that Ukraine matters to us more than it does to you. So when you lose interest, we're still going to be interested in Ukraine. And secondly, he said that the West will never be interested in this war in the long run. They will lose interest and they'll start focusing on other issues. And for Russia, Ukraine is on its border. They won't do that. So what Putin said 2 years ago is coming true.
I think Putin, he's recently proposed a peace plan for Ukraine. How seriously can we take this?
So it's interesting, Yusuf, the peace plan he proposed and the way it was done. And the reason why I say the way it was done is it's not gone down the normal road. So normally when Russia proposes something, it would propose it to the head of another important country. So Russia would usually come to a summit and it would propose it, or it would send the documents and then have a meeting to come and discuss it. So you saw when Putin met Biden, when they met at Geneva a couple of years ago. What happened with this one, Yusuf, is effectively the Russian Information Ministry, they proposed this to Reuters, and Reuters journalists are the ones who made it public. Now, I think there's a number of reasons, and the proposal was, is less talk and less the discussion point should be on the current status, which is the 20% of Ukraine Russia has taken. Let's talk about how we can normalize that. Now, I think the way they did it is interesting, because if Russians don't like this plan, then Putin can argue, well, we never proposed it. It didn't even go through official channels. If it is taken seriously by the West, then he's got at least the bandwidth to say, okay, I proposed it, and now they want to take it further. But as soon as this peace plan was proposed, they launched an attack on Kharkiv in the north of Ukraine. So at the moment, it seems to be that the West haven't taken this very seriously. In fact, they're talking about Ukraine expanding its war effort in the areas that Russia's taken over of Ukraine. So I think the West haven't taken it seriously. However, I think at some point they're going to have to talk to Putin, because the longer this goes on, the longer it's impacting the West, it's impacting their economies, it's having social impact on them, and it's impacting Ukraine. Russia is at the top. Russia still hasn't thrown all its resources at its battle. It can still do that. So the West haven't taken it seriously, but I think they're going to have to take Putin seriously now going forward.
With the US tied up in the Middle East, what's the likely chance that China goes for Taiwan? Recently on the news, China has just completed military drills around Taiwan. Yeah, what's the chance that China does actually go for Taiwan?
When it comes to Taiwan, the Chinese Communist Party, their view is the independence of Taiwan is a slur on their claim that there is only one China and the Chinese Communist Party rules over it. Now, so anyone who engages with Taiwan, anyone that has a relationship with Taiwan, that's a big problem for China. Now, China is in a militarily strong position if it wanted to take back China. Its military is obviously bigger. It's got a navy, got an air force, and Taiwan's, what, around 100 miles from the Chinese mainland. The problem is that the Chinese realized this, that any war with Taiwan, they're not really fighting Taiwan, they're really fighting America. And America will likely join the war or provide significant support to Taiwan. So China really only has one chance at this, and it has to get it right. It can't lose. It can't do what America did, where it goes to Afghanistan and it gets it wrong completely. China doesn't have the option, because what will happen is there'll probably be an embargo on Chinese goods like they've done to Russia. And that will have a massive impact on its economy. Now, I'm more of the opinion, Yusuf, that I don't think China will actually invade Taiwan. I think that's a very risky prospect. They would need to invade, land sufficient forces, and occupy Taiwan. That is very risky for them. They've never done that before. The last war China had was in 1979 against Vietnam. They've not even fought a war for decades. I think it's more appropriate and useful for China. And I say this because if this is based on the recent drills they had that you were talking about. This was a naval drill. And what they effectively did is they carried out a blockade of Taiwan as a training exercise. Now, if you blockade Taiwan, Taiwan gets 100% of its oil from abroad. If they get no oil, within a week, the country will come to a standstill. So I think there's these factors that all are in play, and China will have to decide what to do. But I think we are getting a lot more closer now to China being confident that it should do something about Taiwan. America is bogged down in another region of the world. America's got domestic issues. You look at Ukraine. When China looks at Ukraine, it sees they put sanctions on Russia. they've tried to isolate Russia, but Russia still survived and Russia's absolutely not isolated. That would give confidence to Xi Jinping that actually, if we did move against Taiwan, there's actually very little the West can do. It's a risky maneuver because the international system is underpinned by America. So I think, Yusuf, to answer your question specifically, I don't think China will make a run for Taiwan currently. However, China is watching and learning all the lessons, which is probably giving it more and more confident that it could one day actually do this.
And now, what is the deep state in the US?
Okay, so I think Donald Trump should really get the award for really making this mainstream in America. He's talking about the deep state control America, the deep state, he's there to remove them. The deep state isn't as conspiratorial as people make it out to be. The deep state actually is, in effect, it's like the civil service. So it's the administrative aspect of government. But unlike the politicians who are elected, who are there for terms, the administrative side of any government, it remains forever. So if you're a senior member of the civil service, if you're a senior member of the CIA, you will stay in your position until you retire. So what you find is there are many people who are part of the national security establishment in America. They remain in place even though presidents and governments come and go. And actually what happened was, is when America was created, whoever became the president, they would elect their own civil servants. So when they would leave office, they would take their civil servants with them and the new president would bring them in. And what they started to find was as government grew, as America expanded, this just became impractical. So what happened was, is an administrative system had to be set up who would implement what the politicians had in terms of policies. So these people are appointed by the president. And as the years have gone by, these have become the civil service in some countries. It's become the bureaucracy in some countries. And in America, what you have is, for example, some very independent agencies like the CIA, the Federal Reserve, the National Security Agency, the NSA. You remember the Department of Defense has organizations within it, which are very independent. Now, these institutions, having them people who are actually quite independent, these are people that will outlast the president, they will outlast the prime minister. And it's these people that have quite a deep relationship with many people in the private sector. So the deep state really is a term for these people who remain forever. So these people, they can actually stop the president's policy being implemented. They can delay it, they can obfuscate it, they can complicate it, which has happened in the past. So we know, for example, there was a big divide between the White House when Obama was in the president and many within the bureaucracy over the Afghan war, the direction it was going, what the priorities should be, these sort of things. So the context of the deep state really is no one accepts that the president and the Democrats and Republicans are really running the country. These are the bus drivers. They will drive the vehicle to its location, but the bus, its contents, that's in the hands of someone else. And the deep state is one of the factions that people believe are the real rulers. You've then got big business. You've then also got the Federal Reserve that actually prints and controls the money in the country. So this is a debate that's played out a lot over the last few years. Well, Trump keeps talking about, you know, the globalists, keeps talking about the deep state. So that's really the context of the deep state.
Another question we had in, will the US have a civil war?
So this is probably in the context of, I think there's a raft of new films coming out now which are addressing this issue of civil war in America. What's really happening, Yusuf, in America currently is there is divisions over everything. There's division over abortion, there's divisions over the last election. Was it rigged or not? There's divisions over, is President Biden should even really be the president? There are divisions over the American identity. There are divisions over what America's foreign policy priority should be. And this is tearing America apart. So at the moment, many people are comparing America to when the Civil War happened, because the Civil War was the last event that tore America apart. And what many people in America are concluding is they can't rely on government. They can't rely on the politicians to sort this out. So, for example, in Texas, you got many Mexicans coming over. They call them illegal migrants. And the Texans view it as an invasion. And they have been telling Washington that you need to deal with this. This is an invasion. Washington doesn't view it as an invasion. They see it as just a migrant issue. So there's talk of many in Texas saying that we need to secede from the United States of America, become an independent country, and deal with this invasion. This is where America is at the moment. And really, many of these people supported Trump. many of these people believe that we can't rely on the United States of America anymore. It doesn't work for us anymore. So the prospects of civil war are real. I think 2 years ago, Yusuf, there were a number of retired generals. They wrote, this was after it came public that many serving and retired army officers were part of the Capitol Hill riot. These generals actually said that they believe if Donald Trump doesn't win the next election, at least half America will refuse to accept the result, and someone in the army might even do something about it. So there's a lot of worry in America. The country is divided, and it's very real. Although this is a topic for a lot of films, it's actually a very real prospect. And this will have global ramifications, Yusuf. If there's a civil war in America, then how can America maintain its global empire or give global issues attention when it's got more important domestic issues? So this is definitely something we're going to be watching at Geopolitics, and I think it's definitely something everyone should be watching with.
Final question for you, Adnan. The Iranian president, he died in some very unusual circumstance. Is there more to it?
So it's unusual from the perspective, Yusuf, is Iran does a lot of things that no other country would do. So the first thing is Iran doesn't have GPS on a lot of his internal flights because they believe America can hack into this and use it. So the president of Iran took a helicopter flight to, I think, Azerbaijan or the Azerbaijan regions in the north of Iran. It was very foggy. The weather wasn't very good. And the other problem was he went on a 50-year-old helicopter, which nobody would do in any other country. So I think just looking, I mean, we still don't know a lot of the details because Iran actually kept all of that secret. I actually think we don't know a lot of the details, but Iran actually doesn't know. So because there's no GPS, they didn't know exactly where the helicopter went down. That's why it took many, many hours to find the helicopter. Why was the helicopter even flying when the conditions were really, really bad? And why on earth is the president and the foreign minister flying in a 50-year-old plane? So I think there seems to have been a catalogue of errors, which is probably the more likely explanation, rather than there was something more to it. I have read in some places there's a lot of talk of, is there an internal conflict going on in the country? Or was this Israel talked in the presidency? Was Israel and Iran have a shadow war going on? Now, although there are internal differences, I think there's elections coming up next year in Iran. Look, Raisi was a very bland figure. You know, there's no need to actually kill him. He's not a heavyweight politician. He's not someone who's got a big faction and he's in a battle with another faction. There was nothing of that going on. So for there to be an internal reason seems very, very unlikely. For Israel to have done this, look, Israel, it attacks Islamic Revolutionary Guard officials, Secret Service officials. It targets nuclear scientists. It's never targeted officials. Iran has never targeted Israeli officials, and Israel has never targeted Iranian officials. If Israel was to take out the Iranian president, it's going to have a massive problem on its head. It's the Iranian president. So I think when you put that all together, Yusuf, I think a 50-year-old plane has done what a 50-year-old plane will do, is it will struggle in bad weather.
Thanks for that, Adnan. We covered quite a lot today. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website, www.thegeopolity.com. You can also learn more on many other issues by accessing our website. You'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.